You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 18th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily. We're live here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson and coming up in today's programme, is France facing a perpetual state of emergency? We'll examine a country trying to strike a balance between being careful and getting on with life. Also ahead, a new partnership emerges between the Chinese and Palestinian presidents. We'll look at geopolitics' latest odd couple. And we meet a former advertising copywriter who went on to build a much-loved and wildly successful denim brand.
Having something tangible, something real, that you can hold, and you know how long it's taking to make, it's definitely different. And it has that feeling of, you know, we made something. We're makers.
Plus, is New York facing the death of the diner? And we'll have a look at the Asian newspapers too. That's all to come in the next 60 minutes on The Monocle Daily with me, Emma Nelson. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. The United States has unveiled new economic sanctions against Iran over its ballistic missile program and for contributing to what says is regional tensions. The statement from the US Treasury comes a day after warning Tehran that it was not following the spirit of its nuclear agreement with world powers. More than 500 pupils at one of Germany's most famous Roman Catholic choir schools were physically or sexually abused over a period of 60 years. That's according to an independent report that's just been published. The report accuses 49 members of the Catholic Church of carrying out the abuse at Regensburger Domspatzen Choir School between 1945 and the early 1990s. And Japan's space agency has released the first images taken by a drone it operates on the International Space Station. The internal ball camera drone was sent to take pictures and video of the work of the astronauts. The drone can float in a zero-gravity environment and is operated from Earth. And those are the headlines. Welcome to Studio One. This is Emma Nelson and the time in Paris is 23.02, 22.02 here in London. Now walk into any large business shop or office in France and the little red signs on the wall are a discreet sign, but they're impossible to miss. Vigipirate, the country's national security alert system, warns of an imminent terrorist attack. Well, the feeling in France may very much be that of a country on the rise after the election of Emmanuel Macron, but it is also a country that's been in a state of emergency for some time. And now there's a plan to consolidate much of the temporary terror legislation into something more permanent. Well, Benedict Pavieux is France 24's London correspondent, and also joining me on the line is Rimsera Alouane, a researcher in public law and civil liberties at the Université Toulouse-Capitole. Welcome both to the programme. Benedict, if you could just briefly summarise the journey that France has taken to the point where now Emmanuel Macron, the president, is suggesting that a more permanent terror legislation needs to be indoctrinated into French law.
The journey it has taken is one, alas, of terrorist attacks, almost a regular occurrence, certainly for a while, one of the worst of which was at the end of 2015, 13th of November 2015. And the journey it has taken, therefore, is an exceptional, or what was an exceptional decision, by then Socialist President Hollande, François Hollande, and that is on the night of this terrible attack on the 13th of November, multiple attacks, which could have been even worse had one of them really succeeded in the Stade de France, but we had the Bataclan, that has unfortunately made international headlines. The president decided to install a state of emergency, and what we've had is a renewal six times, including under this new French president. It is now set to last until the 1st of November 2017. This is completely unprecedented since the Algerian War of the 1960s, when I gather the legislation was brought in. It wasn't even planned for in the candidate Macron's legislative programme. And indeed, in his address 2 weeks ago to the both Houses of Parliament, a very solemn address, a very rare occasion at the Palace of Versailles, Mr. Macron was at pains to say that this would restore the liberties of the French by lifting, he said, the order and replacing it with a new, more permanent counter-terrorism law. The proposal is now going through French Parliament, but the clock is ticking very firmly because this, of course, state of emergency is due to be finished on the 1st of November. So how will that be put through? Now, there are very many concerns of 500 people from universities, from human rights organisations, who are very, very concerned indeed that, yes, it strengthens internal security in the fight against terrorism, but it basically makes permanent a series of new powers which are exceptional in the current state of emergency, which would then basically become law. So it gives too much power, these many people feel, to the state, this state, any future state, whether it is about shutting down places of worship suspected of promoting extremism, whether it is of designating public spaces as secure zones, so prohibiting large gatherings, whether it is conducting individual surveillance and assigned residence orders, or indeed house arrests. So quite a lot of disquiet. What is sure is that it is a first huge test for the new Minister of the Interior, Gérard Collomb. And what will be interesting, and one of the reasons that there is such disquiet, is will this legislation that is due to target specifically terrorists and suspected terrorists, and therefore stop further terrorist attacks and protect the French people, which of course is the utmost duty of a French president and a French government, will it actually be used for other reasons, i.e. when this president tries to put through, as he is absolutely determined to do, reform of the Code du Travail, of labour laws, and we expect a nationwide strike on the 12th of September.
Lots to get through there. Rimsara, just listening to that, two things that you can draw from it. The French and France is not a country that likes to have its liberty played with, shall we put it that way? Yet Emmanuel Macron is saying that this is an attempt to protect the French, which is right.
Well, I would start by saying that it's all a political stunt to reassure the people. We are legislating upon emotions. People are scared, rightly so, after all the terrorist attacks we have been through. And the government, public authorities have been accused of doing nothing or not enough. So this is a sort of response to the people. But unfortunately, I think it's quite misleading and it's the wrong way to take. On a legal level and regarding the protection of civil liberties, this is extremely concerning. But by design, by essence, state of emergency is not made to remain permanent, to be permanent.
Benedict, there is this. She said that this is a political move. Would you agree with that?
Well, let me be factual. It is MPs on the left, particularly, who are concerned by the seemingly determined attempt and proposal with this new law, laws, to actually exclude as much as possible a judge in the process. Whereas before you needed a judge for very many, whether it was to decide house arrests, this would give much greater power to préfets, so prefects of regions across France, bypassing in some sense often judges. And this is of great concern to many people. And certainly the candidate Macron had vowed to curb the risk of terrorism through preventative measures, such as increasing the police force with 10,000 new officers, strengthening the country's intelligence apparatus, for example, creating a task force to oversee all counter-terrorism efforts, a new agency. He had not made clear at all that this would happen. In fact, for radicalized extremists, I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, the candidate Macron had talked about having special detention centers. But it is clear that the president feels very strongly about pushing this through, as he does indeed the labor laws that I was referring to. What we should very specifically point out is that the assessment by the French intelligence services after the multiple attacks over a period of time perpetrated by so-called ISIS, the Islamic State, whether it's in the United Kingdom, in Iran, or indeed in France, has not diminished, and therefore the new government, a centre-right government, well, led by a centre-right man, Edouard Philippe, the Prime Minister, is absolutely determined to push this law through.
Rimsara, just to what degree do you think the French are going to stomach this? And Emmanuel Macron is riding very high at the moment. His rating is extremely high, but he hasn't really had to do anything unpleasant just yet.
There is what I call a French paradox. The French, rightly so, love to claim loud and clear that we are the country of human rights, which is true, right? We have great principles that, by the way, Emmanuel Macron said that would be respected even in time of crisis. And at the same time, there is not a lot of, I mean, besides in the circles of civil rights organizations, people are actually embracing this. People believe that more security would protect them from terrorist attack. And I think that Macron and his government are playing around this feeling. People are not protesting. They want more. They want to feel safe. They want to feel safe. And this kind of response gives them the illusion of security. But unfortunately, it does not tackle the roots, the issue of terrorism and radicalization. And this is the scariest part. A lot of French people would be ready, maybe not willingly, to give up on their civil liberties for more security. This is what Alexis de Tocqueville called soft despotism, many little rules that pretend to, you know, make society safer and maybe more organized, which actually is simply not true in reality.
Tell us a little bit more about this soft despotism. I think it may just be described as a benevolent dictator, little bits of people saying, actually, we're protecting you, but in actual fact, you know, a firmer and tighter grip could be taken on the, on civil liberties and what have you. Just place this in context for the future of Emmanuel Macron. You mentioned the labour laws, Benedict. What future? Is Emmanuel Macron just seizing on the day now, realising that the terror laws are going to be controversial and difficult to swallow, get them through quickly. The labour laws are something that really is going to be incredibly hard to push through. Is this something that Emmanuel Macron is just going to have to start pushing through brick walls very, very quickly before his honeymoon period ends?
You're right that I believe he's pushing these two fundamental pieces of legislation. One we knew about, the second one you mentioned, the labour laws. That was very clearly announced by candidate Macron. What was not announced by candidate Macron is this very strong legislation that he wants to push through, replacing the state of emergency. I should just add that Jacques Toubon, the head of the Défenseur des Droits, France's independent constitutional authority, called this legislation a poisoned pill that would in fact threaten France's very cohesion by stigmatizing the country's Muslim population, in fact, by closing down mosques at the, you know, and prayer centers for Muslims at, well, not the drop of a hat, but almost. So the rentrée, as we call it in September, when people come off in July and August, holidays and off the beaches, which is when there's the regular increases. It may seem small, but let's remember there was a revolution almost on, you know, let them eat cake, bread, etc. It's always when the gas goes up and people come back. And we know that there's that 12th of September deadline. We know that the government is in a dialogue with the social partners and the unions. So we know that there's trouble brewing. And you're right. I think he's pushing this through. My experience, geopolitical experience, and by the way, France, I'm sure you know, has been voted today the top ranking in the world of soft power for 2017, which I think is interesting. This is not just soft power. This is tools, legislative tools. And I think this man who was in the government, of course, people always refer to the fact that he was a banker with Rothschild, but that means he has financial expertise. He was Secretary General of the Élysée Palace. He's seen how the inner workings of government work. He's been outside government. He's seen that too. And he, like good leaders know, when I say, you know, when they're astute and he's strategic, that the first 100 days after you elect, and particularly the mandate he got, even if we put aside the whole thing of abstention, is when you can put, you know, when you're at your strongest potentially. And there is no doubt that he's going to use a lot of tools, including shoving this through Parliament as much as he can. He believes in this. He wants it. As he reminded the head of the army the other day, I'm the boss. Je suis le chef.
Bénédicte Pavillot and Rimsara Alouane, thank you both for joining me on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
And you're listening to The Monocle Daily. We're live from Studio One at Midori House in London. This is Emma Nelson. The president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, is in China with his visit, prompting President Xi Jinping to affirm his nation's commitment to an independent Palestine. It was also suggested that the Middle East crisis could be solved with trilateral talks involving the Israelis, the Palestinians and the Chinese. Well, I'm joined in the studio by Steve Sang, who's director of the China Institute at SOAS, University of London. And on the line, we have Alison Kaplan-Sommer, journalist for Haaretz newspaper. Welcome both to the programme. Steve, as you were making yourself comfortable in our studio, I thought we concluded that alliances like the Palestinians and the Chinese, it doesn't come along very often, does it? This struck me as an unusual one.
Well, this kind of very high-level meeting like this is not happening very often. But the support that the Chinese government has officially given to the Palestinian people would go back at least 50 years. So that is something that they have been supporting. But the Chinese have so far been remarkably successful in also maintaining very good relationship with Israel.
I was about to say, if they were very good friends of the Palestinian authorities, they've kept rather quiet about it, haven't they?
Well, they used to be a bit rather more vocal about it in the days of Mao Zedong. Afterwards, I think they've been a lot more quiet, and certainly in the 80s and the 90s, the Chinese were perhaps focused more on working with the Israelis in terms of import of Israeli weapons and military technologies.
Alison Kaplan-Sommer, when you consider China, is the country considered an ally of the Israelis or the Palestinians? Steve has managed to sort of describe a nation which is friendly to everybody.
Right. Well, traditionally, their votes in the UN have leaned towards the Palestinian side, but in very recent years, as priorities of the two countries have come together in terms of focusing on technology and focusing on business, they seem to have a lot in common and are making a lot of common cause. There's many cooperative projects going on between the Chinese and the Israelis in the technological field, and the import-export cooperation is significant. Prime Minister Netanyahu was in China just last March, and he brought more than 100 businessmen with him, and they signed more than a dozen bilateral business agreements. So there's a real push on the Israeli side to improve their relationship with China, and particularly when it comes to exporting to the Chinese.
And when staying with you, Alison, if you are Palestinian and you know that Mahmoud Abbas is referring to China as the best friend our people and the best supporter of our national cause, what traction does that give you if you're a Palestinian leader with other nations and other authorities to say, I've got China's back? Or China's got our back, I should say.
Exactly. Well, I guess if you're Palestinian, you sort of point out the solidarity behind the Palestinian cause from other nations, and that if China wants to be a world leader and wants to stand with the group, it needs to maintain its support of the Palestinian cause. But if you're Palestinian, you do have a huge challenge ahead of you, because because of the position that Israel is in terms of technology and business, and the aggressive policy of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in seeing how some of European nations are being put off by Israeli policies. He's really going after Asia, and it's a strategy on his part to go after Asia. So the Palestinians really have to think about emphasizing their history and their traditional ties, and sort of counteracting what the Israelis are trying to do.
Which, of course, I'm sure, Steve, the Chinese are absolutely loving. Everybody wants to do business with them.
Well, the Chinese are absolutely loving it, as you say. And then they actually are incredibly successful in the Middle East, in the Muslim world. Because in spite of the fact that the Chinese have a very harsh policies towards the Muslim population in its western regions, with the Uyghurs, in fact, you hardly have any major Muslim countries, Arabic or not, who takes up a big issue of the rights of Muslims in China. They get away with it.
So tell us a little bit more about this prospect of a suggestion that's been made of the Chinese acting as the go-between in any future discussions that could be held between the Palestinians and the Israelis, trying to get towards some sort of solution. The Chinese have already said that they back the two-state solution, so we all know whose side they're going for. But to what degree does this now reposition China as a peace broker?
Well, the Chinese have already said, I think President Xi Jinping himself has said that the Chinese government would support a peaceful resolution between the two sides, between the Palestinians and the Israelis. But he hasn't actually done very much about it. So he will continue to say that. And the reality, of course, is that the problems between the Palestinians and the Israelis go back a long way. And up to now, nobody has succeeded. So if the Chinese are not actually getting very far, they are not going to be blamed very much for it.
How much, Alison, do you think any intervention in whatever form the Chinese having in any kind of discussions, how welcome would that be to either the Israelis or the Palestinians?
Well, I think that with an eye towards politics is, part of the tight business relationship that Netanyahu is trying to build with the Chinese. But mostly, he would like to leave politics out of it. He would love for the relationship with the Chinese to remain purely business and not get into some of the political entanglements. But nature abhors a vacuum, and if you look at what's going on with the United States, the America First policy, there is some lip service on the part of the Trump administration towards pushing towards the Middle East peace agreement, but there's a lot less interest in being sort of aggressively involved in the Middle East than previous U.S. administrations. So China probably sees an opportunity here to become a leader and to be involved. And who knows? Listen, both of the countries that have tried to be involved with the peace process and move the parties forward, they've all had these long entangled histories in the Middle East, the European countries, Great Britain certainly, and the United States and even Russia. But what China probably brings to the table as an advantage is that it doesn't have this sort of long, complicated history with past historical recriminations. So maybe they could be the perfect broker to sit down with the sides and talk peace.
Steve, it does lead you to think, doesn't it, that China is definitely taking advantage of an extremely weakened America in all this?
Well, yes, China certainly is. But then why shouldn't it? The reality is that President Trump is creating all this scope for the Chinese to play a more proactive and assertive and in some ways positive role in international affairs. Given that Western countries have for a long time been egging the Chinese government to be more proactive, now they are doing so at the expense of the Americans. And in some ways, by the de facto invitation of President Trump, I don't think we can entirely blame them for doing so.
Steve Tang and Alison Kaplan-Sommer, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. Republicans promised to repeal and replace America's healthcare bill that's come to be known as Obamacare. They failed, so they tried to just repeal it, but they didn't have the numbers. So the latest approach seems to be, if you can't get rid of it, let it die by itself. President Donald Trump has tweeted, so it must be pure policy, that let Obamacare to be allowed to fail and then, I quote, come together and do a great healthcare plan. Stay tuned. Well, David Osborne is the chief US commentator at the Independent newspaper, and he joins us on the line from our New York studio. Welcome as ever to the programme, David. This looks like even more of a mess than I think any of us could have anticipated.
Yes, really, you can't underestimate the extent of the political catastrophe that this is for the Republicans, who since 2010, that's 7 years ago, have made repealing Obamacare at the very centre of their appeal to voters. It's extraordinary, really, that they spent all those years when they were not in control of every arm of office in Washington not coming up with a plan, and then suddenly they have both chambers of Congress in their grasp and the White House, and they spend 6 months attempting to deliver on that pretty straightforward promise. And after many false starts and trips and stumbles, today they finally fell flat on their faces. And it is a setback for Mitch McConnell, the majority leader of the Senate and the Congress. And by extension, it's extremely humiliating for Donald Trump also.
It is the fact that the confusion and the disagreement and the flat refusal to push the bill through did not come from the Democrats. This was an entirely self-inflicted blow by the Republicans.
Indeed, it is absolutely self-inflicted and extraordinary, really, to witness. Essentially, you know, you're right, the Democrats stood on the sidelines. They weren't going to play. The Republicans had a fairly slim majority in the House, but a very slim majority in the Senate, just 51 of them. Therefore, it was Mitch McConnell's job to try and craft something that at least all but two of the Republican senators would support. And he went about it in a very peculiar way. He did everything in secret behind closed doors in the last few weeks. Many of his own members didn't have a clue what was going on and what was going to finally emerge, which, by the way, directly impacts one-fifth of the American economy and impacts the lives of almost every person living in it. And when what he delivered did come to light, it was quickly clear that he had fallen short, because there were enough people on the far right and enough moderates who, for completely different reasons, found the package that he produced to be unpalatable. That was Plan A, which, by the way, was due, according to the Congressional Budget Office, to take health insurance away from about 23 million Americans if it had been enacted. He tried Plan B. That fell apart last night when it became clear that as many as four members would not support it. And then he tried Plan Z, if you like, which today was to say, well, we'll just repeal it, repeal Obamacare and not replace it with anything. That fell apart almost instantly because moderates said, three women senators, by the way, interestingly, they stepped forward today and said, no way, Jose. So he has reached the end of the road. The Republicans have nothing to offer. And as you say, Donald Trump, in his slightly petulant fashion, as usual, has said, oh, well, now we'll just let it fail. It'll all be the fault of the Democrats, and then everyone will be forced back to the table. It's quite a way to run a government.
It is astonishing. And it has been compared to the Joker from Batman saying, do nothing and watch the world burn. We are, therefore, David, looking at a president who appears genuinely prepared to allow the American healthcare system to fail, were it not, I'd argue, for the fact that it doesn't seem to fail.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's extraordinary, really, and it just doesn't work that way. The idea that he can, the notion that he can somehow blame the Democrats for what happens next is absolutely absurd. His party is the party in power and has been for the last 6 months. They're also disregarding the fact that polling tells us that Obamacare is actually more popular now than it ever has been, more popular than when President Obama was actually in office, with Americans preferring by a margin of 2-1 Obamacare with what the Republicans were proposing. So the Republicans have just sort of backed themselves into this colossal ditch. what has to happen now is that they, the Republicans and the Democrats, somehow come together and do what Chuck Schumer, the minority leader, is suggesting, which is, you know, he's acknowledging that Obamacare does have some problems. Premiums are going up. I know that personally. And he has some solutions to fix it. So he will be arguing that, okay, you can't replace it. You've proved yourself incapable of that. The only common sense thing to do now is to make it better, which does make sense. However, that will be very hard for the Republicans to swallow and hard for a president like Donald Trump to swallow. So I don't think we're out of all this mess yet. And just bear in mind, in the meantime, Emma, we're talking about real people's lives. You know, this affects everybody in America. It affects children who are on Medicaid, which the Republicans wanted to strip away largely. It affects older Americans who would see their premiums rise considerably had this plan gone through. It really affects almost everybody, and it is really scandalous, I think, that it has become such a slipshod effort on Capitol Hill, and now who knows what happens next.
The only person who might stand to benefit from this temporarily, one could argue, is Donald Trump himself, given the fact that it provides an excellent distraction from the Russia problem.
Well, yes, that's true. But I assure you, the Russia problem will come roaring back. We've had a day or two of some respite from it, simply because of the dramas over healthcare, which in fact affect, you know, Americans much more than the Russian scandal does, really. But Donald Trump has an opportunity now, though, to say, okay, all right, we should forget it. Let's move on to those things that actually Republicans can agree on, and which, by the way, many voters would like to see happen. It just boggles the mind they didn't do that in the first place. I'm thinking of infrastructure spending, tax reform, all those things. I think that if the Republicans can just get over themselves for a minute and move on from Obamacare, perhaps discreetly doing a few things to shore it up on the side and deal with those issues that people actually want to see happen, they may yet salvage the situation. But right now, after 6 months, they have produced precisely zero, with the exception of one new justice for the Supreme Court.
David Osborne, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. By the sounds of David Osborne and what he's just been saying, it looks like Americans need plenty of places to go and mull over what has been happening in their politics. And for a long time, the Cup and Saucer Diner did just that. It was a mainstay of Lower Manhattan for the best part of seven decades. Regular visitors called it a New York institution, a slice of a city that some say is fast disappearing. But on Monday, it too disappeared. The rent was to be almost doubled. So that was that. But what does the closure of one New York diner say about the city? Well, Sierra Tischgratt is the senior editor of Grub Street, New York Magazine's food blog. Sierra, welcome to the program. Tell us about the Cup and Saucer.
Yes, so this is a New York institution that means so much to so many people. So it really came as a shock that it closed. And it's part of a larger trend of these older traditional New York restaurants that have trouble holding on and surviving.
What is it that's causing this problem? I mentioned a moment ago that the rent was to be almost doubled, and we've dealt in great depth the issue of gentrification here on Monocle, that where it brings great things in so many other ways, in, you know, for the fate of the Cup and Saucer, that is a problem, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is partly like these conditions that are hard to control, which can be a rent spike that even impacted a place like Union Square Cafe that is very far from a diner. It's a successful fine dining restaurant. But, and I don't know if this happened specifically with Cup and Saucer, which I've heard was quite popular, but I do think that these diners, and my colleague Adam Platt's piece touched on this, can become more symbolic than actually places that New Yorkers want to frequent. They like the idea of them. They like walking by. There's this romanticism for old New York. But when it comes down to it, New Yorkers, and this is unfortunately largely what we report on Grub Street, but they want what is new. And they want to try the hottest new thing, and that can actually, you know, that can have a huge impact on the business of these diners.
Indeed,
it's not been, make enough
It's been argued that this is the end of a cult, that we could be looking at the end of a culture of comfort food, which New York, to those who live outside it, people associate New York with enormous portions, double meals on one plate. Is this something that New Yorkers are now turning away from on a very long-term basis?
I think they are. It's a shame. I want these places to continue to exist. But we also are seeing, I reported on a story about Katz's Deli, which is potentially, of all of the New York diners and delis that signify this comfort eating, is I think probably the top one. And they're even modernizing. For the first time in 129 years, they've opened up a takeout outpost in Brooklyn. So it's a matter of, you know, it's a little hard for New Yorkers to have it both ways. They want their institutions to stay perfect and old-timey and not modernize, but I do think it's there takes some modernization for these businesses to continue to stay in business and prosper.
So the owners of the Cup and Saucer say that although the demise of their diner is heartbreaking, they're going to take a break over the summer and then they're going to look elsewhere. Is there a future for the diner in New York? And if so, where should they be looking to set up shop?
Where is a tough question. We're certainly seeing what we consider dining in New York to expand further and further outside the city. I think there is actually a booming market for these more comforting places in Hudson, New York right now. I also think that we're seeing so many more restaurants, whether it's comfort food or more ambitious places, opening in the Bronx. And that will be a huge focus of our reporting moving forward.
So who will survive this in 20, 30 years' time when you walk down the street in Lower Manhattan or the Bronx or Brooklyn or wherever? Who will we see then who we've seen today?
It's hard to say. I think that, you know, Russ and Daughters and Katz's Deli, their future seems as locked down as I can imagine. But it's very hard even for a different kind of restaurant. One, you know, diners are also, the economics of a diner or a deli are very difficult because you really can't raise prices. As much as New Yorkers want these places to exist, they also balk at a $12 sandwich, which is understandable. But those are the realities of raising rent. So I think, you know, even when you're seeing ambitious places that can charge $30 for an entree, still not make enough off the cost of that meal to justify the rent or the additional expenses, it's very hard for a diner and deli to get by with a $6 sandwich.
Food writer Sierra Tischgart, thank you very much for joining us here on the Monocle Daily. To West Wales now to tell the tale of a former advertising copywriter who went on to create a much loved and wildly successful brand of denim. David Hyatt is the co-founder of Hyatt Denim, a company he founded with his wife Claire in 2011 in the town of Cardigan, once home to the biggest jeans factory in Britain. The duo also run the three-day Do Lectures, a mixture between festival and conference, which is held on the couple's farm on the west coast of Wales. Well, Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli spoke to David about his journey.
Yeah, I do believe in purpose-driven companies. I've always been looking for those companies. I love Patagonia. I love what they stand for. I love why they exist. And if you think back to Apple, actually, when they were in the beginning, they were fighting on our behalf of things were too complex, and they were fighting for simplicity. And so I've always loved those companies have a strong purpose, strong desire, and actually want to go and make some brilliant change in the world. For me, I'm like this little guy in a little town going, actually, we can go and get 400 people their jobs back because we have an incredible set of tools. And I want to get my town making jeans again. I'll tell you a very quick story. Sometimes you have to, why do you get out of bed so quickly in the morning? Claudio, who cuts our jeans for us, has cut jeans for 40 years. And he said to me, he said, do you know what I was worried about? I wouldn't have anybody to pass my skills on to.
That's something. I really developed the skill over such a long period of time, and yeah. It could go and become extinct and nobody would know.
Well, and also, like, what's the point in learning in the first place then,
sure,
if it's not passed on? So our town is a maker town. It is fighting for the right to make. We are blessed with the amount of tools we have, not just the sewing machine, but all these incredible platforms that allow us to tell our story further, faster, freer than ever before. And you go, hey, good time to be on Planet Cardigan.
I mean, it's funny because the internet helped you, but also is there something that, some kind of weird alchemy, some like je ne sais quoi of actually making something that's different than perhaps a piece of software? I mean, would you try to convince a tech entrepreneur to, you know what, open a factory or reopen a factory?
It's an interesting thing. Actually, when we see the rolls of denim come in and then we see the jeans go out, it's an incredibly satisfying thing. Actually, you know, we had some brilliant people come down and they founded an incredibly successful game and, you know, sold a lot of games. But when they came down to see the factory, they fell in love with making. And actually having something tangible, something real that you can hold and you know how long it's taken to make, it's definitely different. And it has that feeling of, you know, we made something. We're makers.
Did you learn something that you didn't know beforehand? I'm sure every day you learn something you didn't know before, but were you surprised by any part of that journey?
Well, to start a factory is pretty hard. Even though when you have all the skills, like we are, like 400 people in a town of 4,000 people know how to make jeans. So, but actually starting from nothing is always hard. We want to go and be a global denim brand, but nobody knows us. Yeah, but we know how to make jeans. But actually setting up the infrastructure for a factory is tough. And also, you know, in the first 3 years, I'll be honest, I mean, like you're fighting for the life. You're fighting for the right to make, but you're fighting for the right to stay in business too. And that's a good fight. But actually, we talk about purpose. What it does ultimately is makes you strong. Businesses don't go out of business because they don't have enough resources. Businesses go out of business because they don't have enough resourcefulness. They don't care enough. They don't invent enough. They're not creative enough. They're not hungry enough to go and succeed and actually make the thing that's really important to them happen.
So that's the foundation upon which you build.
Absolutely. And once you've got that strong foundation, it's that code keeps you in the right path.
How do you tell the story of what you just told me? I mean, initially, how did you spread that word? Was it through marketing magic or was it organic?
Before we started, for the first year, you know, I set up some social media accounts and just said, in a year's time, we're going to start making. I created some brilliant followers that actually wanted me to succeed. And so, you know, that story of Kevin Kelly's 1,000 true fans, we built that.
I mean, that's completely true. I mean, so for those who don't know, I mean, it's 1,000 people who are really, really dedicated to what you're doing.
Absolutely.
And that's all you need to grow.
Yeah.
You found that's true because, you know, I'm not an entrepreneur. I don't know if that's actually true, but
it's true because actually, you know, those 1,000 true fans who like really admire and actually, you know, understand the importance of quality, they have 10 friends. And so they become your advertising. I mean, you know, ultimately, your product is the best advertising of all.
Right.
But you need those people who actually believe in quality and actually, you know, it's a great fight, David versus Goliath.
Yeah. When you first started out, did you think that you would expand beyond denim? Because right now what you built is sort of a little mini empire. I mean, did you think that would happen or was that completely natural and it just came about because you got curious?
The problem with living in Cardigan is like the commute is 1 minute. And actually, the other problem with living in Cardigan is actually no one comes down for meetings. So actually, you got a lot of time on your hands. When we think, oh, maybe we could do this, the time normally is the barrier to go and doing stuff. So we have a bit more time than most people just because, and we're really, really good at managing our time.
I imagine you have a big old beautiful kitchen table too, where you sketch everything out.
Do you know what? We have a table designed by my wife, Claire, with a piece of Welsh slate running through it. And I do a lot of work there.
So you've made the Do Lectures. So it started off as a one-off kind of summer camp, and now it's gone way beyond that. What was the inspiration for that?
Well, a friend texted me and sent me a text and said, don't just stand there, do something. And it was from Dick Dastardly, and I'm going, ha. But actually created a conversation around the table with Claire one night, and I just asked the question, it's like, actually, those people who really incredibly inspire us, I mean, they have great stories and, you know, maybe we should get them together and actually tell their stories and share those stories because actually I found those stories to be really useful to help me, to inspire me, to motivate me, to give me the insights to go and do some of the things that we've done. And so that was it. It was never meant to be more than one.
That was David Hyatt in conversation with Daniel Giacopelli. And to hear the full interview, tune in to The Entrepreneurs at 1900 tomorrow on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Monocle Daily with me, Emma Nelson, and in a moment, The Asian Papers. So stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Time is 5:45 if you're an early bird in Beijing, 22:45 here in London. It's time to have a look at what's making the front pages in Asia. I'm delighted to say Vela Narans, a research analyst at RUSI here in London, joins me in the studio with an excellently diverse pile of news to bring us all. Where do we want to begin, Vela? Vela, welcome.
Thank you. I think we should start with the U.S. THAAD missile defense system test, which it has recently conducted over Alaska. Now, basically, this is the test of its famous THAAD system, which it has planted in South Korea. It has tested the intermediate range missile projectile, which it has successfully tested. This is, they say, not in response to Pyongyang's recent claim of an intercontinental ballistic missile test.
No, but it is rather a good coincidence, isn't it?
I mean, it's a good time to be testing missiles, really. This was already planned by the American Ministry of Defense, or the relevant agency, Missile Defense Agency, actually. But it is a good time to be testing your capabilities and to make sure that your allies who have these systems can rely on them.
The THAAD system, is this the same system that is parked on a South Korean golf course at
exactly.
the moment, pointed towards Pyongyang? It makes you wonder, doesn't it, slightly, that they're only testing it now when actually South Korea has actually got it on its own territory, keeping it safe.
Right. Well, I mean, they have conducted tests previously. They've done 14 in total now, but they've done the shorter range missile tests. This is the first time for an intermediate range missile test.
Okay. Right. And what is the significance of the fact that, you know, this is something that Pyongyang obviously will probably pay absolutely no attention to. But if you're in South Korea and, you know, in the last couple of days, statements have been made saying that they are now happy to negotiate with Pyongyang, this doesn't help the process along, does it?
Well, the thing is, I think opinion is so split in South Korea over the THAAD system being placed there. Some people think that it's an effective guarantor of their security. Others think that it makes them a military target. Now, the South Korean president, President Moon, who came into power in May, has sought a more conciliatory tone as well with North Korea. He's reached out his hand to offer talks, and they followed up now with a proposal to engage in military-to-military talks, which would be the first since December 2015, whilst at the same time also proposing Red Cross-led talks in order to re-engage these family reunions, these cross-border family reunions that we've seen since October 2015.
Which is something that the North Koreans like to hold a nation hostage over, isn't it? I mean, just looking at the Nikkei Asian Review, which is where this story is being extensively covered, it does seem it's key, isn't it, that the basic levels of just face-to-face communication between North and South Koreans is the thing that will make any kind of high-level talks happen. But there seems to be such a difference, such a distance between the reunions and this entrenched opposition between North and South Korea that one just wonders whether this is just pure fantasy on behalf of the South.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of skepticism, really, about whether this kind of re-engagement is going to get North Korea back to the table. But at this point, I think that President Moon is willing to give this a go. The previous hardline stance that we've seen over the past two presidencies has not seemed to helped matters.
Okay, let's move on to the Straits Times. Good news for cartographers. Indonesia renames part of the South China Sea. Good news for Indonesia, not so great for the Chinese.
Exactly. So Indonesia has some islands called the Natuna Islands. Indonesia is not a claimant to the South China Sea island disputes, but it does have these islands of which the extended economic zone crosses into the maritime area that China claims. They have now said that in the interest of their own sovereignty and also to ward against illegal fishing in their extended economic zone, they have renamed the sea to the North Natuna Sea. this North Indian Sea also contains a very rich oil and gas possible exploration opportunities, as well as, of course, rich fisheries. So no, China, I don't think, will be very happy. And in fact, they've already dismissed it, saying that it is completely meaningless.
Explain to us a little bit about as to why Indonesia is now deciding to throw its hat into the ring in the South China Sea disputes. And this article says that Indonesia insists it is a non-claimant state in the South China Sea dispute. So why would it actually start to do anything that many people would see as an act of provocation?
Well, there have actually been clashes between Chinese Coast Guard ships and fisheries and then maritime authorities of Indonesia trying to arrest Chinese fishing boats, which it feels are illegal, illegally fishing off the coast of the Natuna Islands. When that has happened, there have been reports of Chinese Coast Guard ships entering the sea and interfering. So this has been a situation that they feel has come under threat from Chinese Coast Guard activity and Chinese illegal fishing.
And also, if you take the Indonesians' actions and then you add them to the Vietnamese extending a concession off its coast, the Philippines Energy Resource Development Bureau, it's saying that it is again laying claim to various parts of the South China Sea. When you have a whole group of countries all united, where does that leave China?
We don't know if they're technically united, though. That's the thing. I think there's been a relative time of peace and calm after the July 12th ruling of the PCA over the South China Sea dispute last year. But there's also been re-engagement by China. And I think there's also been a slight, perhaps frustration over the fact that there are these mineral-rich resources that lie beneath these waters, which these countries would essentially have right to were it not for this dispute.
Let's move to the South China Morning Post. We heard a little earlier in the program about Donald Trump's parlous situation when it comes to attempting to repeal Obamacare and failing, and then just deciding that it's going to collapse. We've had a long-running problem with claims of Russia hacking the electoral campaign of Hillary Clinton, but now the White House has decided to get two foreign presidents, get their names mixed up, and not just get two presidents who are neighbours, but two presidents who don't necessarily get on very well.
I think this is quite unlucky.
That's the understatement of the day.
It's a faux pas. It's a major faux pas. So Xi Jinping was in a transcript called the president of the ROC, which is, of course, the alternative name for Taiwan, despite Trump saying that this is a wonderful relationship that he currently enjoys with Xi Jinping, the president of China, or the People's Republic of China. And at the same time, he's also redesignated the Prime Minister of Japan, Prime Minister Abe, as the President of Abe in a press release. And this is actually not the only one. President of Indonesia, Jokowi, was in a tweet labeled incorrectly when it was actually a photo of Trump meeting the Prime Minister Li of Singapore.
You couldn't make it up. Phil and Owens, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Daily. Danny Goldberg is a figure in music who's found himself in many of the right places at the right time, many times over. His youth was spent following the bands of the hippie generation in the 1960s in San Francisco and New York, and Danny later became publicist for the biggest band in the world during 1970s, Led Zeppelin. Oh, and in the 1990s, he rode the zeitgeist again, becoming manager of a little band called Nirvana. Well, Danny has now written a new book which looks at how the idealism of the 60s shaped both his and the world's outlook. It's called In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea, and a little earlier he joined Monocle's Tom Hall to talk about it. He began by telling him about the context of 1967 and exactly what the lost chord really means.
Even though Bobby Kennedy and Dr. King almost certainly never took LSD, they were affected by the counterculture. And reading what they said, there was an idealism and inclusiveness and discussion about what the meaning of life was. Bobby Kennedy had this speech that said you can't measure everything important in life by the gross national product, which is the sort of government thing of how the economy is doing. And all of these things were happening at the same time. Mm. And the balance of them, you know, the conceit of the lost chord is that the combination of all these things created this sense of possibility and community that didn't last long. Bad drugs came in, tremendous repression from the FBI, the war, the assassinations, and the media, which exploded it and made these ideas known to millions of people, but at the same time killed the deeper meaning of the symbols because they became advertising slogans. But before that happened, believe it or not, when people would say peace and love, they didn't mean it sarcastically.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that I picked up on early on in the book. You say that this wasn't a point of irony. I mean, that really says something about how far removed we are mentally today from that kind of way of expressing ourselves. You know, the fact that we can't say peace and love without a nod and a wink. But you make a point, there's this sort of cliche, if you can remember the 60s, you're not there. But you also say that perhaps something that feeds into that is that it is difficult to define and it is difficult to talk about what was going on mentally in society as a whole. The hippie ideal, it does get opened up to ridicule quite often these days. Tell us what it is about it that was maybe the defining trait, if you can, you know, in a few sentences that you're trying to maybe highlight in this book.
Well, first of all, if I'd been born 10 years later and all I knew about hippies was the sort of cartoon version that got preserved in comedies and in the media, I would make fun of it also. There's no question that the external symbols were, as I say, drained of meaning and worthy of ridicule. But, you know, I give an example in the book when I was 17 and walking barefoot in the San Francisco airport. Now, why I was walking barefoot, don't ask me.
Obviously, I actually do want to ask you because I read that.
A ridiculous thing to do. But they wouldn't let me on the plane and I wanted to get home. It was Thanksgiving holiday and I wanted to see my parents. I was theoretically at university in University of California at Berkeley, although candidly, I didn't go to any classes. My eyes just looked across the airport and instantly saw a guy who had longish hair, was young, and just looked cool, whatever that meant, made a beeline for him. There was this immediate flash of recognition of two brothers, you know, and I explained to him my predicament, and he immediately gave me his shoes. This actually happened.
Yeah.
I don't know what's more amazing, the fact that I just knew he was going to say yes, or that he did it. But I know for sure that a year or two later, that just wouldn't have happened. There would have been paranoia, suspicion, because the predators came in, the bad drugs came in, and the media, you know, as I say, doing their job, nonetheless, took it out of the realm of personal experience. And of course, today, anywhere you go in the Western world, there's a yoga place, a health food place. Those things didn't exist before. So I think that there were elements of it that have made the world better. There are elements of it that become instantly passé. And there are lessons of what not to do, because there was an enormous amount of infighting in the counterculture, like the narcissism of small differences. And that kind of infighting helped self-destructive. This went along with external destruction. You know, no question the establishment was not happy about people who opposed the government. There was a lot of self-destructive. These people became kind of celebrities overnight, didn't know how to handle it. People who figured if the government was wrong about LSD, they were probably wrong about heroin also. It turns out the government was right about heroin and wrong about LSD. So, again, I don't pretend that that energy could last, but it's foolish to pretend it never existed.
That was Danny Goldberg, author of the new book, In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. He was talking to Monocle's Tom Hall. That's all we have time for today's edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, researchers Paige Reynolds and Maya Heergard, and our studio manager, Antonio Fernandes. The Globalist is here in 8 hours' time. Your host for that is Georgina Godwin, and the Monocle Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.